Hello, and thank you for listening to Iconocast. This is Mike Hobrick. I want to welcome you to episode number 25. This is the second part of a two-part interview with Bill Shutt, and Greg Layden talks to him about his book, Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. But first, Greg and I are going to talk about two science articles that we found interesting, and then we'll get on to the interview.
One of the things I had found was an article that my friend Ken Klein sent me. He's a psychiatrist that I know who often sends me really interesting science news, sometimes quite bizarre. And this is a case of a meteorite. I guess it's hard to use the words correctly. A meteor crashed and thus instantly became a meteorite.
Right.
Into her house and ended up in her bed. Now, the story is a little bit muddled as exactly what happened, but apparently it flew, and this was in Canada, in BC, and people saw a meteor. People saw what they later said must have been a meteor.
It was a fireball, right?
It was a fireball somewhere. Yeah. It was construction people that saw it. And she thought, and so did the police, this must be something from the construction site where they were doing blasting. It fell in my house. Mm-hmm. The construction people were like, no, I think we saw something in the sky. And they went and looked, and there's a lump, like a softball-sized thing. And I found a couple interesting, it just reminded me of some interesting things. When I first moved to this house we live in now, I had an idea of a little home science project, which was be to collect everything magnetic that came through the storm drain.
Yeah.
And I was told a long time ago that most of them would be iron-based meteorites.
Really?
A certain amount of our dust is space stuff that comes in as meteorites, technically.
Right.
So meteorites explode. They don't disappear. The elements don't just vanish into quantum nothingness. They just become dust. Mm-hmm. And they fall on us. And a lot of it's iron-based. So the iron-based dust that falls on your roof should include a lot of baby meteorites. You can get them out by putting strong magnets in the output of your gutters. So I assumed that was true. I was planning on it. And then one day I got his book. I'll put the link in. I don't remember the name of the book right now, but I'll put the link in our list about what really comes down from the sky. And especially here where I live right now, we are a few blocks from the site, the launching pad, of Minnesota's largest fireworks display each year. In our little small town of Plymouth, they have the largest fireworks display in the state. And most of that stuff that falls on you mm-hmm. is from house fires, industrial output, and a lot of it's from fireworks.
It's Golden Valley, right?
It's right down the street here
right
in Plymouth.
Right down the street here.
The Music in Plymouth celebration at the Hildy Performance Center. It's the biggest one in the state most years. And if the wind's coming this way, not only can you not breathe because the fireworks smoke is so bad, mm-hmm. but this stuff presumably is landing on us over a period of several hours after the thing. Anyway, most of the metallic stuff that falls on the roof is not meteorites, it turns out. So I was reminded of that. And in this case, in the article, they mention, I don't remember the number now, but they mention how many times a meteor falls on the Earth and someone finds it. Dozens.
Yeah.
At the most. It's not very often. So it's something, and they also don't mention the disposition of the meteorite.
I was kind of curious about that.
They're extremely valuable.
Yeah.
A 2.8 pound meteorite, it's going to be worth tens of thousands of dollars.
She got it back. I think they examined it and they returned it to her. They said it was her property.
Right. She owns it and she can auction it off for a lot of money.
Right. But what I was kind of curious about was this. I mean, it's coming in pretty high speed. It's got a lot of momentum. You know, it's running, mm-hmm. coming in through the atmosphere. It appears as a fireball. But then it lands in her house. You know, it doesn't start the roof on fire and it doesn't start her bed on fire.
Right.
You know, what, I mean, does the roof cool it? I mean, what exactly happens?
Okay, first of all, obviously, if meteorites were on fire, how could alien life come out of them after they burned it?
Yeah.
That's the first thing.
Yeah.
But no, that's a good question. And first of all, it also was, this meteorite did not cause a giant crater.
No.
It didn't cause any kind of crater. So obviously, they must be going really slow by the time they hit the Earth. But they go to terminal velocity in the Earth, which would be like 130 miles an hour probably for something like a meteorite, or maybe 200 miles an hour. And how fast do you have to be going to put a hole in a roof? I know the Mythbusters once accidentally shot a cannon at someone's house and it went through their wall.
Yeah.
So how fast does that go? I don't know. This would be a good Mythbusters episode if they still existed. Like, you know, how...
Well, I think Jamie still does some YouTube videos.
Yeah, the living Mythbusters are still doing stuff like this. I just assume they're not going that fast when they're... I guess what happens is, I suspect what happens is, above a certain size, meteorites don't even notice the atmosphere. Those are the ones that come in, they remain as fireballs.
Destroy the dinosaurs.
They destroy the dinosaurs. Yeah. And below a certain size, they get trapped by the atmosphere and slow down a lot. And so they're all going just fast enough to go through the trunk of your, you know, 1957 Rambler.
Yeah.
Wherever that's happened. Or they go just through your roof. And, you know, they wouldn't get to the first floor of the basement. They hit the bed and they bounce off or whatever. But yeah, that's an interesting aspect of that story, too. And we all just hope someday a meteor lands near us, but not too near.
Yeah.
One of the great underrated movies is the one titled Evolution.
Oh, I love that movie with Orlando. Not Bloom, but is David Duchovny and
David Duchovny, yeah, and a meteor hits in the desert. Yeah. And so these two washed up. One is a washed up biology teacher.
Yeah.
And the other is a washed up some other kind of teacher or something, right? Yeah. And then there's the younger guy who wants to be a fireman someday.
Yeah.
This Forrest Gump's type. Anyway, and the meteor lands by, and of course, there's alien life coming out of it, and it's very impressive. And the big scene in this shopping mall with the flying.
Like, sure develops quickly.
So,
but we won't do any spoiler alerts on that movie. I think people should watch it. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a good movie, Evolution. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you had another one here on COVID-19.
Yeah. So for some reason, this is a study that was done in the richer countries in Europe. And over the last, during the pandemic, they've done studies on what the birth rate has been. And it seems to have slowed down somewhat in many countries such as Italy and Central Europe and so forth. And they weren't exactly clear as to what might have happened and why. I mean, I do know that, like on OkCupid, people may have hesitated to date for a while, but, you know, as soon as the vaccine was available, there was a availability to put on your profile that you've been vaccinated, so maybe it could have picked up after that. But there was a lot of disruption in our economy due to that, and I'm wondering if the anthropologist in the house might have some ideas as far as what might cause the birth rate to slow down.
Yeah, I mean, I do have some ideas. One thing I think is interesting is that we as a society, and most, I think, societies are like this, have less understanding of the most important thing. You know, and we don't understand. The average person walking around will have more misconceptions about birth rate, yeah, fertility, and fecundity. Yet, that's sort of, without fertility and fecundity, wouldn't have a species. So it's just interesting that we know so little about these things, just as people. My favorite things to do with a group of students is to mention that rich people have more babies than poor people. That the myth that poor people have more babies than rich people is a myth,
mm-hmm,
and people become angry. Send me nasty notes. I mean, I get people storm out of the classroom. I mean, it can be intense because this is really just not what people believe. And right now, at this moment in the United States of America, it completely slaps in the face a major theory of society that you see in the right wing, the replacement theory.
Oh, sure.
Replacement theory requires that the undesirables are reproducing faster and or arriving at a high rate.
Yeah.
Right? And what really happens in that regard is that how many fertility rates, offspring production rates among humans, depends upon the context. So people living where your household economy is based upon your household production, in other words, you're agrarian and you have a farm, or you are farm workers working on someone else's farm, your household income depends upon how many kids there are. You have high morbidity and mortality rates among children, so you need even more kids, therefore. And this may be backed up, and it might fit well with a religious belief in having children. And that usually requires women having less power, because that religious belief will be enforced by the men on the women. And so all those things together result in people in certain parts of the world in certain periods of time having large numbers of offspring. When those exact people move, say, from Honduras to the United States, as an example, they will continue to have those practices and beliefs, and they'll continue to have high birth rate. But their birth rate will drop to a fraction.
So the second generation.
And that's the demographic transition. So the idea that poor people have more babies than rich people is reinforced by the fact that when people move from one society to an entirely different society, their birth rate might go down. But it's not a fair question. Rich people having more babies or less babies than poor people can only be asked within a given society. You can't change the rules completely. That's like moving the goalpost to a different... That's like comparing basketball scores to football scores.
Yeah.
Like this team gets more scores than that team. Well, it's a basketball team. The football team has a fewer scores. I mean, it's just unfair. Within a society, we see that people with more wealth and more resources tend to have more offspring than people with fewer resources. And here we have a case where people are shifting to having fewer offspring. So your point is exactly right. It's basically we disrupt the economy, add stress, mess things up, birth rate goes down. Okay. So, I mean, in general, I think it's fair to say that birth rate drops when things improve. Mm-hmm. When you have a demographic transition, you'd have a medical care. Your kids have almost zero mortality rate, almost a low morbidity rate. You don't need lots of them to till the fields because they're going to go to high school and then become, you know, store clerks or museum curators or something else. And or when you have a situation where things get bad and conditions go down and you have a lower reproductive rate. So I think either of those two things can push it. And that's what we're seeing here.
Mm-hmm. I think with the agricultural thing, too, that kind of brings up another point, too, is with the birth rate, but also like the child morbidity rate, where they would tend to have more children just because of the fact that children would die. Like up to the age of five, you have a much higher mortality rate in an agricultural area than when you would in like urban or urban setting where childhood death is not as likely.
Yeah.
And which also kind of brings up the issue. I mean, it's really interesting when you talk about it because so many things pop in your mind. Like one of them is like the reason that the average age of a human is gone up so much is not necessarily people live longer. It's just that more people survive past 5 years right. old than what used to be.
Right.
So you're taking it to the overall mean.
Right. The age at which you die of old age probably has increased a little bit.
Yeah.
There's evidence for that. People age faster in some settings. But that's not the explanation for
right.
change in birth rate. It's morbidity and mortality in younger ages for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
One piece of news is that I suggested to you earlier we might ask John Cook to come on.
Yeah.
He said yes.
Oh, okay.
So we'll get John Cook on here, the author and creator of Cranky Uncle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. We could do that quickly then.
Sometime in the next few weeks he'll be on.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right, well, let's see. How am I going to do this? So, Greg, we read this book by Bill Shutt, and this is on our circulatory system. It is about, you know, like the different stages of evolutionary development of circulatory systems and hearts. And I really enjoyed this book. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to participate in the interview, but you did get a chance to talk to Bill. And before we get into this interview, are there some things that we should listen for that you and Bill talked about?
I think that for me, as someone who occasionally teaches anatomy, I learned new ways to explain anatomy that were interesting. I think that Bill does a great job in his book, as any good science book of this scope would, of explaining things in a way that is memorable and relatable to other things. But there's a second aspect of this book that is very rarely found in a science book of this type. And that is, most science books about a topic will have a few paragraphs or maybe even a chapter in the beginning about the history of science, like how Aristotle was wrong and Galileo said this and blah, blah, blah. What Bill does is he doesn't do any of that in the beginning. And then he goes two-thirds or half, a little more than halfway through the book, I guess it is. That's when he looks at the history of the ideas. And the history of the ideas about the human body, mainly talking about the heart, are fascinating. And I personally had a question that I never understood about why is it that medicine has evolved in the way it has evolved. And his book perfectly explains it. And it's kind of a startling finding, and it's near the end of the interview, and I strongly recommend you listen through and hear about it. It's kind of revealing about the nature of humans and the nature of science.
Well, excellent. I really enjoyed reading it. It's a humorous book. He's very dry wit.
Yes, we're dry with an interesting perspective. The person speaking is just a person, but the audience is not a human being. The audience is whatever form of life happens to come along to read this book. And I think that's kind of a cute way of doing
You're a
it.
blue crab.
If you're a blue crab, you might have disagreed with this point I just made, but
All right. Well, thank you very much. And hope you enjoy listening to this. We're gonna, like I said, we'll split it into two parts and release those separately. So if it seems like it is too short, well, that's on purpose.
I found your description of the woodland frog, however, in a sense, all the stuff you're talking about in here, about circulatory system, respiration, and the heart, all of it. It's that when the rubber really hits the road, I think, is with hibernation. Because essentially your heart beats at a certain rate and your respiratory system is doing something in sync with your heart. And true hibernation, as you describe it here, is really like your heart beats and you take a little breath and then you don't do it again for several months. Then you do it again. Like, how did this woodland frog story is fascinating, and it has an element to it that I never realized before. And so how does a woodland frog hibernate?
Well, first of all, I don't even know if you would consider it to be hibernation, because a lot of hibernators, their blood doesn't freeze solid, their heart is still beating, they're still breathing, and they wake up during the winter and move around a bit, and then they go back to sleep. So it's a way to sort of to get through times when there's no food out there. I mean, I've worked on bats for 30 years, and that's primarily the way that bats, you never see bats hibernating in the tropics because there's food year round, but there's no food in New York or Pennsylvania, insects for these things to eat. So they've evolved a way to slow down their metabolism, but they can still wake up. So you always tell people, stay out of the caves. You don't want to wake them up because they have an energy budget that they're on. They've got this fat stored between their shoulder blades, and that's what they burn when they wake up. And if you cause them to wake up, when they're not supposed to be waking up, then they can run out of that fat and they'll die. But the northern woodland frog is very different. It has evolved this. First of all, they live in areas that were like Canada, where it gets really cold and can be cold for long periods of time during the winter. And they've evolved a sort of a different take on this. They allow their entire body to freeze solid, the heart, the blood, it all solidifies. So now, as a biologist, when I first started looking at this and I talked to researchers, I was like, doesn't that damage the tissue? Because if we were to do that, if that would have happened to us, when the water in our bodies solidifies, crystallizes, those jagged crystals would tear up cells, tear up tissues, tear up organs. So how is it that these frogs are able to survive being frozen? I mean, we're talking like frogsicle, frozen like a rock. And so what takes place here is that as they start to cool down, their livers release a tremendous amount of glucose. And that glucose causes water to leave the tissues and to accumulate outside the cells and tissues. So I asked these guys, where does it accumulate? Basically their abdominal cavity, right? And so I said, well, how much ice are we talking about in here? And they said, well, it looks like a slushy if you open it up. And so by doing that, their tissues are able to freeze, and they've sort of sequestered all the water in places where it's not doing any damage. And so that's clearly unique in the animal kingdom. They tried this experiment with a couple of other similarly related frog species, and it didn't work. Frogs died. And they don't know what the stimulus is that wakes them back up. I said to them, is there some type of what is it that initiates this the heart starting to beat again? And they said they don't know. And so I made a little note in the book that this needs to be looked into. If it's a to me, it's a perfect graduate student project. This is what I do when I write books. I'm thinking about, like, okay, so if you really want a cool project, this one hasn't been done yet. So get out there and do it.
That is an excellent example.
Yes. So just, I mean, very unique. And there are all sorts of cool ways that animals cope with cold, and some of them have, you know, tie in now to medicine, Antarctic ice fish, things like that.
Yeah. Okay. On the frogs, I'm going to predict. This is like Darwin predicting the existence of a moth with a 2-foot long proboscis. I will predict somewhere in Eurasia, there is an equivalent homologous frog that is part of someone's cuisine in frozen form. That's just got to be true. But another thing about that I thought was really fascinating is that the process starts when ice begins to form around the frog and in the frog itself, which causes an exothermic reaction, because freezing is exothermic, which sort of stimulates and like frenetically, this is a frenetic, you think of hibernation as being, it gets colder and you slow down, it gets colder and you go to sleep, it gets colder and you're in a deep sleep. This is like, it gets colder and all of a sudden, all this frenetic biological activity starts happening over several hours to do all these transformations you're talking about.
Oh yeah, especially with the glucose release. That wouldn't happen if everything was starting to freeze. But you're absolutely right about that. There's an energy reaction that releases heat, and that's what allows this these chemical reactions to take place that set up a differential between the tissues and the non-tissues so that the water leaves the tissues. It's fascinating.
Yeah. So this is not a frog sitting in a slowly boiling pot. This is the complete opposite. You did mention the ice fish. This has been in the news lately. These are fish that don't have red blood cells, I guess, right? They just use a different way of getting oxygen.
Yeah, they don't have hemoglobin, and so you wonder how could a fish survive without hemoglobin? And there's this list of reasons why we think this mutation happened about 5 million years ago. And so how could they survive in those types of conditions, that Antarctic water? And that's one of the reasons they have survived, because if you don't have hemoglobin, you can't, unless you have, you know, hemocyanin, a different pigment to carry oxygen around your blood, then you're sort of out of luck. But there, as I said, there are a list of reasons why they're able to be successful, and you get things like, well, cold water carries more oxygen in it. Their blood vessels are 4 times larger than a normal blood vessel in a fish that size. Same thing with the heart, tremendous sized heart, and no scales. So here's one. So the oxygen just diffuses in from the outside, enters into the circulatory system, which is large anyway, and is able to sort of pump blood around, and it's got antifreeze substances in their blood that prevent it from freezing. And their metabolism is really low. They sit on the bottom. These are not super active fish that require tremendous amounts of oxygen. They're sit and wait predators. So all of these things put together equals, you know, Antarctic ice fish has been able to evolve adaptations that allow it to survive in some crazy conditions.
So this might be a great example of a great piece of luck where a mutation that relates to hemoglobin occurred, and if had it occurred in a tropical bird, that would be the end of it for that particular individual, that mutation. But here it worked. It's also, though, an example of everything alive today has been subject to the whatever environmental conditions the Pleistocene has thrown it at them. So and that means cooler conditions sometimes, and sometimes often drier conditions. And it was about 5 million years ago. I don't know if there were continental glaciers 5 million years ago that grew in size, but drying conditions started then. It's the late Miocene, beginning of the Pliocene. So this might be one of the most extreme examples of an organism adapted to the present that will not be, conditions of which will not be extant with significant global warming.
I mean, that's a whole lot of global warming if you're talking about warming up the Antarctic Ocean to the point where it doesn't carry, where the water doesn't carry as much oxygen anymore. I think these things have been, you know, that's certainly, global warming is clearly problematic, but I don't think that, ichthyologists are worried about that it's gonna have a major effect on Antarctic ice fish. I might be wrong, but
that's a good question. And that I was saying that too. I'm not really sure the extent of it. What the Arctic is unique, what makes the Arctic is air temperatures do not go above freezing.
except for in that one peninsula that the ice melts off of. And that allows the ice to melt only a tiny bit in some places in the summer because of sunlight. But that's what's changing, is that the air temperatures are going. So who knows? I mean, you're right, though. It's probably too cold for that to happen. Let's switch gears a little bit. First of all, I just want to say, when it comes to the biology of the circulatory system, I just want to make listeners understand, we have not read the book to you here. We've just touched on highlights. It's full of stuff that we have not even mentioned. And so just, you know, don't think you're getting away without reading this book. But the second, we're kind of running out of time, but you spend a fair amount of time talking about modern medicine of the heart. And that's really interesting to me. And that's the kind of thing, by the way, when you're doing anatomy and teaching it, that's the kind of stuff that captures students' interest a lot, you know, heart surgery and heart therapies and so on. But there's a mystery that I have always worried about that you solve in this book that to me is really, really important. And I'm going to give you the entree to this discussion by noting the following. In about the 1850s through 1880s, there existed, and for 200 years before, there existed technology, the same exact technology that's used today in a general sense, by physicists and astronomers. Okay, they had a method for looking at light, and they knew that looking at light was the key. And then they had math that let them understand how objects spin around and circle each other. And looking at light and understanding how objects spin around and circle each other is the starting point for Einstein's theories of relativity, and it's a starting point for quantum mechanics, and it's a starting point for everything we have in the way of cosmology. Every single thing comes down to those concepts and technologies and tools, some of which go back to the 16th century. And you can take us up to Maxwell, who died in 1879, who wrote the equations that puzzled Einstein, that caused him to go forward with his great thinking. Meanwhile, over in medicine, we've got people thinking that milk can turn into blood. And we have the invention of the stethoscope in the 19th century. The telescope was centuries old. We have, you outline and chronicle concepts of medicine that were wrong for centuries, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary at any given moment of time. How did that happen?
Yeah, that was sort of interesting, because when I was writing a book about cannibalism, I asked the question, why do we have this knee-jerk reaction when you mention that word? And the chapter was originally called Blame It on the Greeks. And so when I looked at, you know, I started off by looking at a question, where do we get this idea that the heart is tied into emotions and intellect and the soul? I could have named that chapter Blame It on the Ancient Egyptians. And so not only did they come up with this idea of cardiocentrism, that the heart is the place where you look if you want to, you know, if you want to know where emotions come from, for example, but they had a rich medical record. And they had a lot that was wrong. And so, for example, and I could go through this list, and I'm not trying to mock them, because they were an ancient society. They didn't have anywhere near the tools that we have nowadays. So, for example, they thought that the arterial, that arteries carried air and veins carried blood. Now, that information, that Egyptian medical information, was held in really high esteem by the ancient Greeks. And so from the ancient Greeks, so we're talking about Hippocrates and Aristotle, and they were convinced that the heart was, you know, the place where you could look for the soul, etc. This gets passed on, and so this information gets passed on to the Romans as well. Now, meantime, the artists are jumping in there going, oh, cardiocentrism, so we can write all of these beautiful poems and paintings and all of this stuff depicting the heart as the center of emotions and intellect. But the science was not so good. And when you get into the first and second century of Rome, you had a surgeon by the name of Galen. And Galen was, if anything, he was well-written. 3 million words of his were recorded. And Galen took a lot of what he determined was based not on being able to work on humans. It was not allowed. He could only work on animals. And he got a lot of stuff wrong himself and picked up a lot of things wrong from the Greeks and from the Egyptians before him. So things like the four humors, in order to keep you healthy mentally and physically, you had to balance these four liquids that travel throughout the body, one of them being blood, then black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm. You know, the fact that black bile doesn't exist, you know, that didn't bother people, I guess. But in any event, after Galen died, and he lived in the second century CE, and after Rome fell, his works, which, as I said, 3 million words, were not immediately translated into Latin, which was at least in the West, it was the language of scholarship. And so they sat. And then the early medieval period, his works were finally translated into Arabic by Syrian Christian scholars. And so when the West finally translated Galen's work into Latin, it was from the Arabic that was written by Christians. So there was this sort of Christian slant on that information. And when the church saw that, church leaders read these things or heard about them, they were like, this is the end all, that's it. You don't need to research, you don't need to do anything. Galen's word is divinely inspired. We follow everything that Galen says rather than have any type of research or questioning what he might have said. So for 1500 years, that was the, in a sense, in the West, that was the law. And so you, in a, really, it was a time of stagnation in the medical field, where in other areas that you were getting tremendous innovation. So that was a bit problematic.
Yeah, and that's like, I had noticed, just by chance, several years ago, I worked on an archaeology project in Minneapolis, which was in a place called, a neighborhood called Elliott Park, which is named after Elliott Park, which is a park. And that was named after a guy named Elliott, who was a major patron of the hospital that was there. When the hospital was torn down, they made it into a park. And it was the Minneapolis Homeopathic Hospital. And it existed in the 1920s, 30s, mainly. And at the time, in the early 20th century, if you wanted to get cured of a disease and you went to a regular medical facility, you'd probably get sicker. You might get sicker, depending on what disease was. If you went to a homeopathic facility, you wouldn't get sicker, because homeopathic medicine, the credo is, for the Hippocratic Oath says, do no harm. The homeopathic oath is do no thing. Don't do anything. And in that sense, there was this brief period of a few decades in American medicine where I think homeopathy was better than modern medicine because it didn't do anything. Whereas modern medicine was throwing leeches on you and giving you arsenic and whatever else. You have a list, you have a couple paragraphs in your book. You're talking about ammonia, arsenic, bitter ale, bismuth, this long list of things that were included in medicines, some of which were, probably did have medical uses, and we might even use them now, but doctors are poisoning people in the early 20th century. And we had a society in which every Western city had multiple hospitals, and medicine was, like you said, ruined. It was in the last decades of that period of a couple of millennia of it not advancing and being really backwards. And the fact that it was codified by religious belief is the part I didn't know. That's you talk about that and document that in your book, that it was like all science was under the thumb of the church at various times. We all know that, right? Galileo. But somehow medicine got more strictly controlled and wasn't allowed to advance, and we're behind by decades.
In the West, I mean, in other places that didn't get the airplay that we have here, then there were advances in places like the Middle East and in China. They were off doing their own thing. So you got to sort of, put an asterisk on that this right. is not a worldwide phenomenon. It's just that not a lot of attention was paid to that sort of thing for a very, very long period of time.
Yeah. The other interesting thing I thought, and I've always kind of wondered about this, is how important is the role of sterile or at least relatively clean small tubes. I mean, if you go to someone, visit someone in the hospital and they're reasonably sick, there are tubes sticking in them in all different parts. And the technology for those things couldn't have been around in the Middle Ages. How do you make a tube that you can act? And you talk about the early pre-angioplasty, you know, people sticking tubes into their veins and developing those technologies, along with stories about heart, mechanical hearts. I had forgotten about Baby Faye. I had forgotten about Barney Clark.
Right. Baby Faye turned out to be, you know, people ask me, what was the thing that most affected you when you, after writing this book? And it was the Baby Faye story, which ultimately it was tragic. But it turned out to be sort of the anti-Galen, because it was, yeah. For your listeners that don't remember this, in 1984, a surgeon by the name of Leonard Bailey transplanted a neonatal or newborn baboon heart into the chest of a desperately ill dying baby who became known in the media as Baby Faye. And Baby Faye lived for 20 days and did not die because of a rejection of the baboon heart. The baboon heart worked great, but died for other reasons that I talk about in the book. So this was tragic that this single mother lost this child. But it was also the stimulus for the reason that Bailey did this surgery is because there were no donor neonatal hearts. So with all of the media coverage after this took place, then there became this kind of ways for people to donate if they lost a newborn, to donate their hearts. And Bailey did over 200 surgeries on infants transplanting hearts, never had to go back and do a baboon heart because of the media coverage that Baby Faye received. And sort of on the other side of that coin, the defects that characterize some neonatal hearts, instead of a transplant, they can go in now and fix the problem. And so I showed this incredible series of surgeries that in the case, so if Baby Faye were around today, if it were born today, they wouldn't give her a heart transplant, at least not for several years. They would reroute her heart so that the left side, which didn't work very well, wasn't really doing much at all. And they would just change the circuit of the blood flow so that the right side was pumping the blood out to the body. And the blood returning from the body, instead of going to the right side, would go directly to the lungs. So all of that, I think, happened because of what was at the time a very tragic incident. And to me, it was the opposite of Galen, where this thing just, this stagnation and lockstep following of this ancient surgeon just carried on for 1500 years.
Yeah, and the other, that's fascinating. And the other aspect of that I thought was interesting with both Baby Faye and Barney Clark, who was a recipient of a mechanical heart, is the outrage about the lack of ethics behind yeah. those operations. And I'm looking at those operations, I'm thinking, there is no lack of ethics here, but it just freaks people out. I mean, Baby Faye was going to die, and this was a bold experiment. And Barney Clark, I mean, he was going to die, and it was another bold experiment that everyone agreed to. And yet the public reaction to it was powerful. And like you said, it changed the way things are done. And also exposed that I think people react to things without, the way people react to things, the way our society reacts to things doesn't always make sense.
Yeah, in the case of Baby Faye, and especially, the media was really cruel to the mother because she was a single mom. They were really cruel to Bailey because they thought that he was seeking recognition and fame. And in reality, nobody ever said a bad word about Bailey. And he never performed another one of these surgeries. Baby Faye almost died the night before. They basically told Baby Faye's mom, well, you could take this. This is before the transplant was offered. You could take Baby Faye home and it'll die. You can keep it at this hospital and she'll die. Or you can move it to another hospital and she'll die. So that was it. There were no alternatives. And And so initially, at least, the media coverage was very negative, and it got better. It did get better.
Yeah. Let's end with this. Let's end with something that has to do with the future, I think, more than the past. And that is the current status of the technology that involves perhaps building a frame. And this was something done here at the University of Minnesota. Doris Taylor, unfortunately, she's been poached by Texas. All great work in the University of Minnesota is followed by someone getting poached by Texas. Who basically created a framework, a collagen framework from a pig heart,
mm-hmm.
to use to build a human heart. And that overlapping technology with CRISPR. Is CRISPR currently being used, actually being used to modify transplant material to make it useful? Or is it just something that's on the drawing board right now?
There are all sorts of research efforts right now to cope with the fact that we just don't have enough donor hearts. And so one way to look at it is a xenotransplant, where you take a pig heart, but you now have to worry about things like viruses, and porcine viruses are problematic, just like primate viruses would be problematic if you were going to transplant, a baboon heart. But you're not going to transplant baboon hearts anymore because they don't have enough offspring. Whereas pigs crank out a lot of babies, and you could generate potentially a lot of hearts. So yeah, that's one way that we're trying to make provide hearts that could be that could take the pressure off the fact that we don't have enough human hearts. Now, by the same token, I went up to Harvard and followed up with Dr. Harold Ott, who's taking what you mentioned before. He's taking a donor heart and stripping away with a detergent drip all of the cells that your body would react to if you took that heart off of a donor and just put it into any person, not matching up tissues, not matching up blood types. That would be the problem. So what he's doing is getting rid of all of the cells that your body would have a reaction to. And then the idea being that if you were going to receive this heart as a recipient, they would take a sample of your skin. Not a deep biopsy or anything too crazy. They would take a sample of your skin and take these cells called fibroblasts. And the technology exists now to convert those cells into stem cells, which the body or can stimulate to become any type of cell. And that exists. Then take those stem cells and stimulate them to become cardiac muscle cells. That technology exists. Now you've got culture of cardiac muscle cells that match the recipient. Now what you do is seed those on this structure, on this collagen model of a heart that's left over from the donor. And at a certain point, then you transplant that heart into the recipient. So I asked Odd, I was blown away by it. And I said, what type of time frame do you see here? And he said, within 10 years. And that, if you think about that, that's amazing. So in a sense, you're growing hearts to order rather than having to wait around to get the right blood type or the right tissue type, or this one is in Alaska. Now we have to transport it across the country. And it wasn't just heart, it's kidneys, it's livers, right. it's other organs as well.
Yeah, one of the least accurate things in modern medicine is predicting when the thing you're working on now is going to actually matter. And in many cases, you look back at that and think, well, we thought that because we did a completely different thing in the end. So we'll see. I mean, I would not be surprised if CRISPR technology ended up being used more directly in sick hearts, more likely than in just like rebuilding existing hearts rather than replacing them has had more potential these days.
So some people would argue against that. Like, I think the example that that Dr. Ott said is, you don't fix your radiator, replace it.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Who knows? We'll see how it goes. Anyway, I think we're out of time. And Bill, this was a great interview. I think this is a great book. I'd like to know, when can I get my copy of the final version?
Oh, the final version, it's been out now for going on 3 weeks.
It's been out for 3 weeks now. Okay.
Yeah, it came out on September 21st. So it's available anywhere that books are sold.
That books are sold.
Yeah, any place, in any format.
Excellent. I will then, we'll make sure that people have a link to get it, to get their copy. And thanks very much for your time. And can I ask one final question? What's your next book?
My next book is that I'm working on right now is about teeth.
Really? Interesting. Well, we'll be looking forward to
To me, it's right up there with cannibalism as far as strange, strange phenomena.
The most interesting teeth to me are obviously I've studied one of my major contributions in my own field of anthropology is explaining changes in hominin teeth. So send me your stuff on that and we can talk about it. I might have some a story or two to tell you about it.
Sure, no doubt. I'm still writing this one, and I haven't quite gotten to that section yet. Where I work at the American Museum of Natural History, and where a lot of my colleagues, especially the older ones and the ones that came before me, a lot of what they know about prehistoric life and the planet itself is based on tales told through teeth.
For a huge amounts of what we know, teeth is all we had. And an interesting situation is Gingrich et al. Published on Darwinius, which is a primate skeleton, and titled the paper something in reference to the term missing link. Hmm. And a lot of science writers at the time were getting extremely hot under the collar about the misuse of the term missing link, which is an arguable problem. But Gingrich is making a joke, which is actually very funny and completely lost because most of the science writers couldn't get the joke because they were so apoplectic about the use of the word.
Yeah.
Darwinius was the first fossil to link the history of primate evolution through teeth of that era versus the history of primate evolution through postcrania. We didn't know how to put the lineages together. There's two fundamental different forms of postcrania. And we didn't know which one went with the teeth in the primary lineage people were studying. And of course, this is a whole skeleton. So you had the teeth in the postcrania and was able to answer the question directly.
Yeah, that's usually the problem, though. That postcranial skeleton is far more rare in the fossil record than teeth are. Teeth are by far and away the most abundant fossil for vertebrates.
Right. There are entire lineages that are only known through teeth.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. Thanks very much. And we're going to sign off and pass this on to our listeners.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me on. Take care.
Okay. Have a good day. Bye now.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this two-part episode with Bill Shutt. His book is Pump. It's out now. We do have an Amazon link in the posts for this. And we will have a new episode up. We haven't actually scheduled the recording yet, but keep listening. One thing that would really help would be if you would like it on your podcatcher and then share it. And once you've done that, then more people will be able to hear it and eventually we'll build an audience. And thanks again. This is Mike Hobrick with Iconocast, and I want to thank Greg Layden for working on this with me.